Welcome to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. I'm Mike Papali, and I'm the president and founder of In a Heartbeat, a nonprofit organization with a mission to prevent death from sudden cardiac arrest. I witnessed sudden cardiac arrest at age 17 and have been living with heart disease for over a decade. This podcast will dissect the physical and emotional obstacles of living with heart disease and how to overcome them. I am inviting you to join me on my personal journey of living as a heart disease patient. The ultimate goal of this podcast is to help heart disease patients of all ages live a long and normal life. Welcome back to another episode of A Big Heart. I am your host, Mike Papali, and today we have a very special guest, Dr. Colby Salerno, and he is going to tell his remarkable journey of being diagnosed with HCM and how it has led him to do the work that he is doing today. So without further ado, here he is, Dr. Colby Salerno. All right, we now welcome on a very special guest, Dr. Colby Salerno. Colby, thanks so much for taking the time to be here with us today.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. I love what you do.
Yes, we kind of knew of each other growing up in towns like maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 miles apart. And we also recently learned that we were diagnosed originally by the same doctor, which is really cool. So I'm really excited for you to share your story. And I just think it's inspiring. First and foremost, and I think it's just a valuable resource for so many people out there that are going through similar things. So I want to get right into it. And I think one thing, you know, that I learned about your story that I think is very valuable for other people is when you were a kid, you know, soccer was your life, but you did have some symptoms. Can you just kind of talk through that? Because I think it's hard for young people to kind of like understand what symptoms feel like. And so any insight you could provide there would be great.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of patients who have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, there's such a wide range of how it develops in people and how it manifests. So for me, though, I was pretty symptomatic around the, you know, fifth, sixth grade is when I first started to really notice it. I was playing on 3 soccer teams at the time. Like you said, it was, you know, my life. At least I thought it was my life. And I initially got diagnosed with exercise-induced asthma, and I was on 3 inhalers. And the reason they did that is because I was getting so short of breath with any significant long-distance running or, like, you know, halfway through the soccer game, I was really struggling. So they gave me these 3 inhalers, all of which weren't helping at all. And then it really progressed to when I was like really getting into it, really getting intense in my aerobic exercise, you know, to the point where I just completely had to stop. I couldn't really move. At times I started to feel like my vision was starting to go on me, like it was starting to black out on me. I felt like my hearing was getting, you know, decreased. And then I just never felt like I could catch my breath until I would sit and stop. You know, I remember just you're 11, 12 years old and you think you're playing like the most competitive leagues, you know, in the country and stuff. And I remember that I would go and like fake an injury and I would pretend like my ankle was hurt because I just couldn't breathe. And I just wanted to sit down in the grass for a little bit. And it's just like one of those things that is like, unfortunately, probably a core memory of mine. But, you know, those were the main symptoms, I would say, severe shortness of breath. And then when it got really bad, I felt like my vision would get blurry, my hearing would become limited. And then like just my muscles and stuff were weakened.
That's interesting because I've always said, like, because people ask me too, like, did you have any symptoms? And when you're a kid too, and you're like playing sports, sometimes you feel like, you know, when you're like trying to beat other kids out. So when you're like working out, you're like, I'm kind of supposed to feel like short of breath. I'm supposed to feel maybe a little dizzy and out of breath. So I think that's really helpful because I think it's important for kids to be aware of those symptoms. And obviously if they are feeling them to make sure they tell a doctor. But then, so you actually got or from there, they kind of heard something on a stethoscope. I know when you were in middle school, which, and that's relatively rare, right? For someone with HCM.
Yeah, you don't hear it a lot unless there's obstruction, you know, of the outflow of blood as it's leaving, you know, the heart. There are maneuvers that doctors can ask patients with HCM to do that can sometimes accentuate, you know, the murmur and make it easier for them to hear it. One of them is like asking patients to like bear down. You can have patients stand up bedside and have them squat and stand and listen. But unless there's a significant obstruction, a lot of times you don't hear it. In all honesty, I'm not sure what they heard. It was actually a medicine resident who just was like, I think I hear something. There was, you know, they weren't super confident about it, but he said, I think I heard something. That plus the symptoms I was having playing soccer, it was like, I think we should at least take a look. And that was what led to the echocardiogram, the ultrasound of my heart.
Cool. And is that when you first met Dr. Heller?
Yeah. And that's when I met her. She did, you know, I don't know if people care about this, but this is something that I like, you know, as a cardiology fellow and future cardiologist, she did the echo herself. And that's just, I don't know if that's a pediatric thing or if that's just 20 years ago thing, because I don't do echoes myself. I read them, but we have ultrasound techs and everything that are sonographers that go out and get the images for us. And then I read the images. So she was sitting right there, probe in hand. And she, you know, will tell you as soon as she saw the first images, she pretty much knew the diagnosis.
Yeah, this is kind of goes to show you. So we're both, you know, patients of Dr. Heller, and she's amazing. And it's another tribute to her and, you know, how caring I think she is. So she delivered kind of the same news to both of us. You know, as a basketball player, you're a soccer player, and she told you about the diagnosis and also told you, you know, you can no longer play soccer and do something that you love. Just kind of curious kind of how that conversation was. Obviously, wasn't great, but how you handled it. And also, you know, any advice you'd give for somebody that has to have that same conversation with their doctor?
Yeah, great question. You know, I was 12 years old, so my memory, I'm 35 now. So we're talking about a memory that's 23 years old. My parents will tell you that I handled it amazingly. I don't remember this, but they say that I said, you know, it's not worth dying over. I don't remember it, but if I did, that's a, you know, a nice mature thing for a 12-year-old me to have said. But at the time, I'm 12. I think I'm going to be a pro soccer player. It's the only thing I really care about. And so I think, like, what am I going to do with my life? I remember crying and, you know, in my bed and stuff, thinking, like, what am I going to do? That being said, I guess I quickly moved on. You know, Dr. Heller was an amazing enough doctor that I thought, oh, you know what? I maybe want to just do what she does then with my life. And I initially thought I was going to be a pediatric cardiologist. I've now transition to becoming an advanced heart failure and transplant cardiologist for adults. You know, I guess I'm impressionable because, you know, it's like the last doctor that I saw left the like biggest impression on me. But for those who are facing it, I think, and I give bad news to people every day, whether it's I'm diagnosing heart failure or not really diagnosed a lot of HCM, but I have diagnosed it once or twice, and we're telling people they need a surgery or a cardiac catheterization or a defibrillator implanted. And I think it's easy to get bogged down in that initial shock of it all. I think the biggest recommendation I can give is a week later, a month later, take a second to digest this news and then realize that it doesn't define who you are. This is huge, I think, in the heart transplant world, which, you know, I'm sure you'll get to, and that's that I'm a heart transplant recipient. And that's a lot of people, that's kind of how they define themselves after. And I recommend not doing that. I think it's a huge part of my life. I love the connections I've made because of it, but I didn't let it define me. And that's where I've, you know, moved on. And, you know, I like to define myself now as a cardiologist who happened to have had a heart transplant.
It's a great way to look at it, because when you are a kid, they say you kind of define yourself. Like, I did the same thing. I thought I was going to play in the NBA. And then I had like no sense of reality that there was going to be a life after basketball. It's just like what I did. But like reflecting on it now, and similar to you, like it was really hard for me, but doing some of the stuff that I do, that I get to kind of work around AEDs and cardiac arrest, that, you know, I allow that to kind of be what defines me rather than like having the condition and being, you know, a survivor. That's a great way of looking at it. So like, what was the treatment? So they did not put an ICD in right away, right? It was, they kind of just were, you know, no more soccer, probably some medication.
Yeah, exactly. So I think at the time it was verapamil for me that I was started on. And then there's just different criteria that doctors use is to put in a defibrillator, especially if you haven't had sudden cardiac arrest like yourself, or arrhythmias that are could be lethal, or big thing in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is if you've had a syncopal event. So if you've passed out before with HCM, that's worthy of a defibrillator. I didn't have any of that. So the thing that led me to a defibrillator was when I was 14, the thickness of my heart had gotten to a point that Dr. Heller recommended a defibrillator. So that's when I got my first defibrillator when I was 14 years old.
What was that kind of like experience, recovery like, and how was kind of life after getting the ICD?
Yeah. So my mom reminded me, so Mike was actually on my podcast and my mom listened to, and she reminded me that I had the same doctor put in my ICD as you did as well.
We have a lot of things in common.
Yeah. So to be honest, it was an easy surgery. It was very, you know, well tolerated. The biggest thing I remember is I'm 14, I'm starting high school. I was very insecure about the lump in my chest more than anything else, like about the defibrillator. So I remember being at like pool parties and I would quickly take off my shirt and jump in the water and think to myself like, oh, okay, that, you know, people can't really see it as much and things of that nature. I think, you know, that's something that I don't feel anymore, especially I got scars everywhere now. You know, it's not something that I'm concerned about, but it's something easily a 14-year-old would be concerned about. That was my biggest concern until it shocked me for the first time. And that kind of changed, you know, my thought process on it for sure.
Just if you don't mind me asking, was it a necessary shock or a accident mistake?
It was not a needed shock. It was, I had hit the heart rate threshold. So my heart rate had gone high enough that the defibrillator has settings. And then based off of those settings, it shocked me. And then because of the adrenaline rush that gave me, my heart rate did not slow down with the shocks, and then it went on to shock me 8 more times. And so I was out actually playing paintball in the woods with a bunch of friends, and you know, I remember it like it was yesterday. It just kept hitting me with shocks. And if for those of you out there with defibrillators and stuff, if you've been shocked by them, you know it's like a kick in the chest, and then when it keeps going, it really starts to make you think, you know, you know you're gonna die. That being said, I know how amazing they are and how life-saving they are. It's just you want them to be used for the right thing. And we're, like I said, we're 21 years since then. We've gotten even better at defibrillators being able to track rhythms appropriately and everything like that. So I'll tell you what, if anyone's listening to this who's a candidate for a defibrillator, I would still 1000% recommend them. I would do it all over again, even having gone through that.
Yeah, I actually kind of find myself in the same position. Mine's never shocked me, but I did have a bad experience with, you know, a lead extraction. And I'm always like, you know, you have to talk about it because it's a real thing that happens and can happen. And I'm always worried that it's going to make someone hesitate to get one, because I don't have enough good things to say about my ICD because it allows me to have the life that I have. And that's, yeah, without it, I mean, I would be scared to do a lot of the things that I just do, which, not that I'm doing anything crazy. It's just like normal active stuff. At that point in your life, what were you doing? So you said you were kind of playing paintball. You know, were you, when you had the ICD, other than like not playing soccer, was life like relatively like normal? Did you have like a ton of limitations?
I was still limited by my symptoms. So I was still very symptomatic with any true level of exertion. So even just playing paintball, like if I would try and run from people, I would struggle. You know, I would try and like walk leisurely and just stay hidden and stuff like that. I tried a few times to just play like a little intramural or like just pick up games. And that was still a struggle for me. So I led a mostly sedentary lifestyle for sure. That being said, high school was fine. I had friends. I went to parties. I went to prom. I got decent enough grades, I guess, to eventually go to medical school. But, you know, other than that, life was completely normal. It was just the lack of athletics from, you know, what maybe I would have hoped.
Okay. So you eventually decide to go to Tufts in Boston. And again, another parallel between our stories, because I did the same. And, you know, I know you kind of went there knowing that you might be having to have a minor surgery, but that was not the news that you got. Can you kind of talk through going there and how that came about?
Yeah. So I had graduated college and I was planning to maybe try and be a paramedic to boost my resume for medical school. Looking back, I would have never survived being a paramedic with how bad my heart had gotten. But I had told Dr. Heller, actually, I was 21 years old, still seeing Dr. Heller. And I had told her how bad my symptoms were getting. She got concerned and sent me to one of the world's best hypertrophic cardiomyopathy doctors, Dr. Marin at Tufts. And so I had a bio degree. I thought I was going to be a doctor, and I had done all this research thinking like, oh, I must have an obstruction of blood. They can just go in and, you know, shave off that obstruction or use alcohol. They can put it in to try and ablate or decrease that obstruction. That was all in my brain of what I thought I was maybe going to go into. Dr. Marin did one test, which was he was echoing, you know, ultrasounding my heart again, but this time before and after being on a treadmill. And then he came in the room and was like, this is what I'm seeing, that, you know, you're only at that time now 22. He's like, you're only 22 years old. He's like, you can't go on living like this. The only thing that's gonna, you know, save you is a heart transplant. And that was an absolute shock to me. I didn't realize I was headed down that road. And so, yeah, I mean, I cried way more that day than I did the day I found out I had HCM. That's for sure.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I've always said like that, that's like news. Like, I mean, like, obviously it's not easy to get news that you have heart disease. It's not easy to get news that you can't do something you love, but man, to like, just the thought of that for someone that's young, you know, a transplant is so scary. What happened from there? Did you, you know, go home and kind of like just take it all in and kind of figure out like where you were going to go, what you're going to do to make this happen?
You know, so Dr. Marin was like, all right, you know, you can go home today. We're going to bring you back and run a bunch of tests, and then we're going to get you listed, you know, for the transplant. So I kept traveling to Boston from Connecticut. So like a 2-hour drive for me. And then eventually I did all the tests. I got listed for a transplant. And then they said at the time, which is just, you know, this is not the case right now, but Hartford Hospital in Connecticut and Tufts in Boston were part of two separate groups in a way of how organs could come to their hospital, I guess is the simplest way for me to try and explain it, which allowed me to get listed for heart transplant at both hospitals. Okay. And so I met the transplant team at Hartford. They got all the information for Tufts. And the decision at that time was like, I'm going to get listed for both. And while I'm at home, at least if either of them call with a heart, that's where I'll go.
And, but you ended up getting admitted to the hospital. And actually, this is a question I have. And not every person that's awaiting a heart transplant has to get admitted to the hospital. Am I wrong in saying that? Some people are able to wait from home.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's kind of, you know, the criteria for listing patients for hearts is different than it was 10 years ago when I got my heart. They made changes in 2018, but still the same, where there's different criteria, different levels. And it's the whole idea is to try and give the sickest people the hearts first, right? And so depending on how sick you are or what type of support system you need, that depends on how you're going to be. So for me, I was not a candidate for a left ventricular assist device or LVAD, as everyone calls them, which is a heart pump that you can leave the hospital with and go home with. And then you can get called from home and come in and get the transplant. You know, the size of my heart and the size of my left ventricle was not amenable to that. So the medications they wanted to put me on were medications that they felt I should stay on in the hospital and wait until I get a heart because of how, you know, terrible I was feeling. The main symptom was I would start to eat really large meals. And then as the blood would shunt to my stomach for digestion, I would feel symptomatic, like short of breath. And it was pretty much when I told the doctors about that, they're like, enough is enough, time to put you in the hospital until a heart becomes available.
And I can't imagine when that happens, you're just kind of like in a waiting game. And for you, you're sitting there on day one and it's like, you could get a call tomorrow, or you could get a call, I don't know, in a year or longer, right? I mean, what's that like mental battle like, just not knowing when that call is going to come?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, really tough. I was 23. I ended up having my 24th birthday in the hospital. So I was still very young. I felt like my life was on hold. And I felt like there was people who were out there like doing things that I wished I could do. Like I knew people who I graduated with who were like getting into medical school, which had always been my goal. And I really felt like life was passing me by. And that was the hardest part of it, is the psychological toll that it took on me. From a heart standpoint, I felt fine. You know, I wasn't out trying to run or anything. I was just allowed to walk around the floor in the hospital. And so I wasn't really symptomatic doing that. So just the sitting and the dauntingness of just sitting day by day waiting for them to come in and be like, a heart is available, what was the toughest part about it?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I The most I've been, all your friends are going through like different milestones in their life, even like 6 month period, right? They're graduate, they're hanging out, they're Christmas, holidays, whatever it is. It's, I mean, I can't imagine. There's only so much, you know, I'm sure you had like a great support system and as I did, but there's only so much those people can really do to make you feel better. It's like they're coming and they're entertaining you for a little bit, but at some point visiting hours are over and they go home and it's like, now you're just like laying in bed and it's just you. That's hard.
Yeah. And then you just start to resent things. And then it's like, I didn't want people around. But then when they weren't around, I was mad they weren't around. And, you know, I started to like hate my blood pressure cuff. Like just having it sit on my arm started to like make me go insane. And I get to be on both sides of this now. So I'm a doctor now. And I tell my patients one night in the hospital is one night too many. And so I ended up living in the hospital for 6 months. And it was 6 months I was there before a heart became available. So I know what it's like to be there for a really long time and how rough it is.
I know one of the things you started doing was you started writing a blog, right? And what was that for? Just to kind of like talk about your experiences. That, do you do anything with that anymore? Or is it just something you kind of just reflect on? Obviously, now you're helping patients, so you can kind of really get a feel for the feelings you were having at that time.
Yeah, I don't do it anymore. It's like a piece of history now that's just like sitting there on Tumblr, which Tumblr was, I guess, a decently big thing in 2011, 2012 when I was in the hospital. Honestly, I don't even remember. Like I just started to write, and I think it was just like a way of me saying how crazy the situation I had found myself was in, and then a way of just like continuing to connect to people who were, you know, outside of where I was living. I called it Tales from the 10th Floor because I was living on the 10th floor of the hospital. And then I just started blogging about everyday life, some of the stuff I was seeing. I mean, if I go back and read it, it's like, man, I was losing it. Like, because I wrote a blog about a hawk that I saw from the window that I decided to befriend and stupid stuff like that. But then there's stuff that I'm proud of. Like I wrote an anonymous letter to my future donor about how much I would cherish the gift of a heart and things like that, that I'm still proud that I wrote.
Wow, that's cool. So eventually you get the call or someone comes in and tells you that, you know, they have a heart for you. You know, that's got to be probably one of the most relieving feelings you've ever had in your life. I can't imagine.
It's, to this day, it's like you can't even explain it. It's, especially when you were there, like for people who get so sick that they're like unconscious and, you know, get listed for transplant and then they get a transplant in like 2 days, it's like they don't even have a time to digest it. When you're sitting there for 6 months and then somebody comes in and says that, the emotions are so overwhelming because you're freaking out. You're about to undergo open heart surgery and they're literally taking your heart and going to give you a different one. You're so happy to finally be done. You're sad because that means somebody died and likely a young person if you're getting their heart. And then it's so much that I explained it to people as like, I felt like I was numb, just kind of sitting there, like just trying to come to terms with everything that was about to happen and how my whole life was finally going to change. And for me, it was a change for the better. That's for sure.
Yeah. And being wheeled down to the OR for a heart transplant surgery, obviously relief is one of the feelings you're having, but it's not a routine surgery, obviously. You know, what were those feelings like kind of just a few minutes before you're going in for a pretty intense surgery?
You know, my family had showed up. I have two sisters, and then my mom and dad were there. I had my sisters play like classical music, like almost like something like the Gladiator, you know, like where he'd be coming into the stadium type of you know, song. And and I had them playing that as I was wheeled off the floor to get me like ready for it. And then thank God for anesthesia, because, you know, then you're laying in the room and then the next thing you know, you're in recovery. And so
that's when it gets hard for the family.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the family's all sitting there waiting to hear that the surgery went okay, whereas you're knocked out the whole time. I mean, I was freaking out. I was 24 years old, about to undergo open heart surgery. Nobody wants open heart surgery, especially at that age. Yeah. It's just, I think like when I go back to it again, I was so overwhelmed by so many different things that it's like hard to explain even what it truly was like. It's easier to explain what it was like waking up.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question. So what was it like waking up emotionally? But also I'm curious kind of like physically, like how did you feel?
Yeah. So that's the biggest takeaway. So I had gone so many years at that time now with a weak heart. And then when I came out of surgery, I felt like I could hear my heartbeat in my skull. Like it just felt so strong and so different than what I was used to. And so that feeling was crazy. I was able to sleep, but I remember just like when I would lay down to go to sleep, I just felt like my heart was beating out of my chest. And it was such a new feeling to have. I was up and walking the next day. I was home, you know, in 10 days. And then it was a whole new life. And then I can't remember. I one of the big things I did, though, after was I trained a little bit and ran a 5K. Wow. And so that was just like one of these things. And I hate running, but I did it just as like this is what the new heart is capable of. And I don't think I would have been able to run a 5K since fourth grade, probably. Was the last time I would have been fit enough to run a 5K. So it was an amazing feeling. I took up skiing afterwards, is something that I learned, went hiking. It was amazing.
So it completely transformed your life. All right. So I want to kind of flip to what you're doing now. And it's incredible that, you know, like you said, you've kind of, you know, I guess you had the feeling, knew that you want to be a doctor probably after the first diagnosis. You thought you were going to be like Dr. Heller. But at what point were you able to go back and get, you know, start applying to med school right away? Or was there like more of a recovery, or did you just kind of get right into that? This is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to start studying and make this happen.
Yeah, pretty much. When I was in the hospital struggling mentally, I thought to myself, like, man, imagine if my doctors knew what it was like to be in this situation. It was at that point I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to go into advanced heart failure and transplant cardiology. I had been out of school. My college grades were good, but they weren't great. So I decided I was going to do a 1-year post-bac program, like a grad school program, to try and boost my GPA and my resume. And I actually applied to that while I was waiting in the hospital, and then got into a program at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. And then I started that 7 months after my transplant, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 7 months after my transplant, I went to grad school. And then, so my transplant was in 2012. And then in 2014, I started medical school.
I've been very passionate about this since, not since my cardiac arrest, but since I was like mature enough to understand that I think I could have benefited from learning from somebody that had gone through something similar to me. I have in my life had amazing doctors, as we've talked about, but I've always said it's so important also to kind of get the perspective from a patient. So like as a patient, connecting to other patients is really important, and you do both, which is incredible. Can you just kind of talk through that? Like, you know, when you're sitting across from a patient and you're able to use the scientific side of your brain, and then you also use the experience part of your brain, what kind of value does that add to those conversations?
I definitely think it adds a lot in terms of a trust factor. I think the patients trust that what I'm saying is accurate because I know how terrible it can be and how rough it can be on their end. I think they realize if I'm going to ask them to do something that I've been through myself, I'm not asking them to do it just, you know, lightly. I understand the work it's going to be putting on that they need to do on their end. I think it can give them reassurance, especially seeing how relatively young I still am. And then also how well I'm doing after going through all of that. I had a recent experience with a gentleman who needed a defibrillator, and he was, I think, like 40 or in his 30s, something like that. He was very young though, compared to my normal patient population. Mm-hmm. And he felt like he was way too young to be getting a defibrillator. And I happened to tell him, you know, I was 14 when I got my first defibrillator, you know, something like that, that really makes him think like, okay. Like one, that's an example of him knowing that, you know, it's not like he's the only person that this is happening to. Two, it makes everything I'm about to say after that kind of more legitimate. So I'm going to tell him what it was like, how I went and lived a completely normal life with a defibrillator. And I think, you know, I can give reassurance like that to my patients that, you know, most doctors cannot.
Yeah. I just can imagine that. Like it's, you know, sometimes when you're just going through it, it's like, oh, this person doesn't understand. And you like actually did, you know, you really, really, truly understand, which is invaluable. I mean, it's invaluable for patients. It's really, really cool. You just recently published or had your first publication, and it's about improving you know, the time where patients are in the hospital, improving that time for them. Can you kind of talk through that and how people can access it as well to read it?
Yeah. So I just finished a project I had been working on, where I interviewed 15 heart transplant recipients from across the country about what it was like waiting in the hospital for their transplant. Some of this was kind of before the changes in 2018. The most of them, though, were after those changes. So still people were in the hospital waiting. And the main thing that I hypothesized, and because I had lived it, was that the time waiting is rough because of the medical side, but it's a lot rougher just because of the lack of control and the lack of amenities that you're used to. For me, it was showering was the biggest thing. So they let me shower one time in 6 months. And that was just as I was switching out a catheter that I had in my neck. So it came out that night, I showered, and they put a new one in the next morning. Other than that, I was using these gross wipes that like left like a film feeling on you. I wasn't allowed outside. I was only allowed to walk around this little area. The food was not good. I didn't know where I was on the transplant list or how long I should be expecting or how any of that worked. And I didn't feel I was getting a good example of what life could be like afterwards. There was one person who had a transplant who was willing to visit, but there was no connection between me and that person about kind of, you know, age-wise and life goals-wise. So big picture is I interviewed all these people, and a lot of them felt like what I felt, you know, it resonated with them. So a lot of them, the ones who had access to showering, talked about how amazing it was. The ones who didn't talked about how much they would have loved it. Same with going outdoors. One of the big takeaways was that they would have loved for recent transplant recipients to come visit them and let them see somebody who had just been through it, especially people who are on like the same demographics, you know, so 50-year-old women visit 50-year-old women, or at least close to that, to allow them to see people who are like them succeeding. The way to access it right now is it's in the Journal of Cardiac Failure is the name of the journal. And then it's called I Just Wanted Nothing More Than a Real Shower. And so if you look up my name in Journal of Cardiac Failure, you'll probably find it. But it will, you know, once it, we can try and find the link and have you attach the link as well.
Yeah, cool. I can do that. That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. Again, I went 2 weeks without the shower, and I remember just being like, this is like the worst. So I can't imagine. So, and then the other thing that, you know, I know we talked a little bit about the video that, you know, I watched of you today. And when you stepped outside post transplant, that was the first time you had been outside in 6 months.
Yeah.
My God.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, and that alone, like, just, you know, we just like being in the sun is like healthy, you know. So on top of like your own health issues, you're also in a situation where you're, This is not super healthy to not be outside.
Yeah, I don't even think I was taking vitamin D pills.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. All right. So it's been 11 years
now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just had my 11th anniversary.
Yeah. What? If you talk kind of about the patient side of your life now, how normal is it? Are you going in? How often do you have to go in for checkups? Is there other things that you have to be like cautious of now?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, you're trading one thing for another, as any transplant patient will tell you. You're trading, for me, heart failure for immunosuppressed life, I guess, is the, you know. So I'm immunocompromised because I take medications for my body not to attack my heart. I've done very well from that standpoint. I haven't gotten very sick. I got COVID and I did okay. One of the worst things post-transplant is heart biopsies. Mm-hmm. So they go in through your neck with a catheter and they bring, you know, a little clamp down and they take pieces of your heart and test those for rejection. And those are not fun at all, but I don't need those anymore. I haven't needed those in years and years and years. And so now I do 2 doctor's appointments a year for my heart doctors. I try and see PCP, dermatologists, and all that. And then I get ultrasounds of my heart, echocardiograms, every 3 to 6 months as well. And then there's a specialized blood test nowadays to check for rejection using different DNA markers. And so it's just drawing my blood and doing that. And then I take pills every day for the rest of my life. I'm lucky enough that I'm on pills that are once a day pills. So I take all my pills in the morning, which is extremely rare for somebody in my position. Most people have to take them 2-3 times a day.
Mm-hmm. Makes it easier to keep track of, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you could give one piece of advice to a person that's just been diagnosed with heart disease, you know, so they've kind of gotten that bit of a blow in their life, you know, what would that one piece of advice be?
Exercise.
Yeah.
You know, you had told me kind of what we would talk about today. And that one just came to me off the cuff. Yeah. Just, yeah. You know, and when I think about things that I've seen benefit me and benefit people in life, especially patients that I'm taking care of with heart disease and stuff, man, exercise goes such a long way. Mm-hmm. It's so beneficial going into a surgery to stay as fit as you can. It's so beneficial for long-term effects on the heart, on the bones. I think deconditioning, meaning the body just starting to break down if you stop doing stuff, has such detrimental effects. There's plenty I could say, but that's the one that came to mind. And never smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, cool. All right, so want to talk about some of the other stuff that you do outside of all your busy things that you have going on. So you have a great podcast that, you know, I was lucky enough to be a part of at one point, and called Both Sides of the Stethoscope. Just talk about what it is and how people can listen to it.
Yeah, so like you said, it's called Both Sides of the Stethoscope. It's on any podcast platform that anyone uses. So you could just search it, or you can search me in a podcast platform. It's myself and one other doctor. Her name is Aline. She also had a heart transplant. She's an ICU trained doctor. And we kind of just talk about our unique perspectives about literally what it's like being on both sides of the stethoscope, being doctors and patients, how we navigate life, how we navigate our job, and, you know, just our unique perspective on things, I guess to say. And it's been enjoyable, and it's allowed us to talk to people like you and hear really cool stories of other patients or other doctors out there who've had organ transplant and things of that nature.
That's awesome. Cool. And last thing, I know this is something you're very passionate about, but just for anybody that's unsure if they're an organ donor or unsure, having a hard time make that decision if they want to be an organ donor, you know, if you could just talk about the importance of being an organ donor and how, you know, why people should really consider being one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very touchy subject just because it's very tough to talk about in the moment. So if you have a loved one who passes away, the last thing you're going to want to think about is their organs being taken out. It's too tough at that time. It's something that you need to talk about now when you're awake and healthy, and just let your family know what your wishes are.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the importance, you know, hopefully I'm an example of what organ donation can do. Hopefully people see that just, you know, giving me a new heart has allowed me to become a physician, help other people. It's allowed me to have a family. It's given me 11 years, and hopefully it's going to give me many, many, many more. My approach to it is, you're not going to use these organs afterwards. You know, taking them with you is going to serve no benefit. And you got to ask yourself, if you found yourself in heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure, needing an organ, would you take one? Mm-hmm. And if you would, I think you should also be willing to donate if you found yourself in that position.
Very, very well said. And I agree. That you said it in a very professional way. I would have just said everybody should be an organ donor, but you know, it's a really important thing. And obviously for me, you know, hearing your story is just a really makes the decision really easy. So is there anything else you want to add that I didn't cover or we didn't talk about?
No, I think we hit on most of it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. I think, you know, if people want to follow along, I have the Both Sides of the Stethoscope podcast. We have an Instagram account. I share a lot about my life on my Instagram, which is at Dr. C. Salerno. If anybody wants to see, I'm trying more and more to share literally the life of a doctor and patient all together at the same time.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm excited to follow along. And now that we're both in Connecticut, I know we're going to connect soon with our former doctor. So that's great. So I appreciate it, Colby. Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Yeah. And thanks for having me. Very impressed with what you're doing for people to try and prevent, you know, sudden cardiac death and everything.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to A Big Heart, a podcast about living with heart disease. If you liked this episode, it would mean so much to me if you could give it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Like anything in life, the goal is to improve. Please provide any feedback you have, any topics you want to hear, or any guests that can provide value to our listeners. You can message us on Instagram at A Big Heart Podcast, or send us an email at mike@inaheartbeat.org. To learn more about In a Heartbeat and the programs we provide, please visit www.inaheartbeat.org
That is www.naheartbeat.org.